Okay, good afternoon. Today I am pleased to announce that Australian Prime Minister Julia Gillard will visit New Zealand on the 15th and 16th of February. This will be her first visit to New Zealand as Prime Minister of Australia. I believe the visit will strengthen the already strong partnership between New Zealand and Australia and will continue a long-standing tradition of regular contact between the Prime Ministers of our two countries. From our perspective, the New Zealand government will use the opportunity to push with Australia for further progress on a single economic market. The benefits for both countries of a single economic market include enhanced productivity, reduced costs of doing business, and greater opportunities for innovation. We want to make doing business easier, no matter what side of the Tasman firms are operating from. A press release has just been issued, which contains some of the highlights of the program. One in particular I'd like to mention is an address by Prime Minister Gillard to members of the House of Representatives in the debating chamber. She will be the first foreign leader to do so. I believe this will be a highlight of the visit and underscores the special and unique relationship between the two countries. A short while ago, Minister Wilkinson announced that the minimum wage will rise from $12.75 an hour to $13 an hour on April the 1st. The training and new entrance minimum wage will also move up from $10.20 to $10.40 an hour. Since this government was elected, we have raised the minimum wage by $1, which equates to $40 a week. The 25-cent increase, combined with last year's tax cuts, ensures that workers on the minimum wage have received the buying power of their have maintained the buying power of their wages. The increase represents a 2% rise in line with the CPI. Moving the minimum wage to a higher rate, for example, $15 an hour, would most likely have a negative impact on the country's unemployment rate. Calculations calculations from the Department of Labour show up to 5,890 jobs would be lost if the minimum wage was increased to $15. Taking a steady approach to the minimum wage has helped prevent workers being priced out of the job market. Tomorrow Parliament resumes for the year and I'll be delivering a statement outlining the National League Government's broad program. Our program this year will focus on achieving two of our key goals. We will build the foundation for a much stronger economy and build better results from the public services New Zealanders rely on. These are the platforms upon which New Zealanders' aspirations rest. In the speech I gave nearly 2 weeks ago, I concentrated solely on the economy. Tomorrow's statement is a broader outline of our program, touching on a wide range of areas. We've been clear that we want to build a strong economy based on real, enduring growth to deliver New Zealanders the jobs, improved incomes, and improved living standards they desire and deserve. Tomorrow you'll also hear more about our focus on building better results from our public services. It's important that we get better results from those services so we can improve the lives and well-being of Kiwis, help solve social problems and improve the prospects for the next generation. I'll be speaking in the House at 2 o'clock and copies of the written statement will be circulated to you under embargo late tomorrow morning. In terms of my activities this week, tomorrow I'll be opening the McDiamond Institute conference before going to caucus as well as making my statement to Parliament. On Wednesday, I'm in Wellington and will be attending the parliamentary Chinese New Year celebrations. On Thursday, I'm going to the Waikato, to Botany and to the Helberger Woods in Auckland during the evening. On Friday, I'll be travelling to Greymouth for the day. There will be no scheduled public events until I arrive in Christchurch that evening for a fundraiser for the Pike River Miners Relief Fund. And finally, on Sunday, I'll be at the Big Gay Out in Auckland. Tomorrow, the House resumes, as I mentioned, at 2 o'clock. I'll present my statement to Parliament. The rest of the week will be taken up with the debate on that statement.
Just on a recent development this afternoon, the Māori Party has moved to suspend Tony Hauora from its caucus. What's your reaction to that? Is it technically a government MP?
Well, there's solely a matter for the Māori Party. I wasn't aware that was happening up until about 45 minutes before the public statement was made. I was advised by the co-leaders of the Māori Party. But I think it reflects what has been some underlying tension that's been quite evident for some time now between Honi Harawira and the rest of his caucus. And I think, you know, ultimately, it represents the frustration from the Māori Party leaders who very much want to be part of the solution, very much part of a government that's actually resolving the issues for New Zealanders, as opposed to Honi Harawira, who fundamentally wants to act as if he's in opposition.
So you would presumably welcome that move, and that you've said that he's a part of progress, if you like. I mean, you would presumably welcome the fact that he's not now part of your coalition partners.
Well, what action they take is obviously a matter for the Māori Party co-leaders, but you know, at the end of the day, we have a constructive relationship with the Māori Party, and that's a relationship that's based on finding answers to problems. And from what I can see, that's not the space that Honiharawera has been in.
Are they prejudging their own disciplinary process, though, by doing this 2 days before a meeting?
Well, I can't answer that question, but my understanding is that they're clearly independent events.
Do you have any concern about the longer-term implications for the Māori Party and its future as a potential support or coalition partner with National?
Well, ultimately, whether they have long-term support for National will be a matter for the National Party leadership and for the Māori Party leadership. That's something that we would want to have discussions about. We're in a position to do so post the election. Ultimately, the issue, I think, of whether they are a relevant player or not is something that will be determined on November 26th when we have a general election.
But aren't you concerned that the party could completely split in two? Because Tautau is a very big portion of the party.
Yeah, I wouldn't want to jump to conclusions on that. It wasn't entirely obvious to me that Peter Sharp has got a bad reception up in Waitangi in the weekend. So, look, I mean, at the end of the day, we're going to have an election on November the 26th. New Zealanders will decide where they put their votes, and as a result of that event, we can determine who can put together a government.
How much are you involved in those support parties in this year's budget?
Sorry, one more time, would you?
Are you involved in those support parties in the formulation of this year's budget?
We always do, relative to their portfolios or any budget bids they may make. Obviously, all of our support parties are aware of the fiscal constraints we're under, but I've no doubt that they will present their own bids, and we'll work our way through those as logically as we can.
But would you expect them to have decent trophies out of this year's budget?
Look, there'll always be some requests, and we try and accommodate them where we can, notwithstanding the fiscal constraints that we have. I mean, last budget was dominated from the Māori Party's perspective from Whanaora, which was a big gain from their point of view. There were others, and it's just a bit too early to know exactly what their requests will be, but everyone is aware, all of our support parties, that National is totally committed to running a new budget spending component that sits within that $800 to $900 million window, so there's not a lot of cash to throw around.
There's been criticism of the minimum wage increase from both politicians and minimum wage workers. Are you satisfied that the increase has gone far enough?
Look, I am satisfied that the move's gone far enough. I think we need to put a bit of perspective around this. So the minimum wage has improved a dollar, from $12 to $13 in the time we've been in office. That comes on the backdrop of the worst global recession since the Great Depression. And this is always a balance between lifting the wages of those who earn the least and ensuring that they keep their job. And I, for one, would not have been at all comfortable raising the minimum wage by a lot more than what's currently occurred if it resulted in people losing their jobs, and I believe it would have. In the case of we'd gone to $15, well, nearly 6,000 New Zealanders earning the minimum wage would have received the news that they're on the dole queue. And I think there has to be balance here between the level of wages and employment opportunities. I think we've also got to say, look, as we've seen with the unemployment rate, it's a fragile recovery. It's one step at a time. Again, the Reserve Bank and Treasury and others are more optimistic for this year, but we can't and we shouldn't snuff out that recovery by pushing too hard on wage increases right across the board, whether they're on the minimum wage or the general wage round.
Prime Minister, the Trans-Tasman partnership negotiations are commencing again next week.
Yeah.
According to the US Trade Representative, you have withdrawn or you've retracted your comment that the idea of investor states resolutions would be far-fetched or that New Zealand was opposing them.
Well, firstly, let me say a few things. I'm not aware of any statements that the US Trade Representative has made. I simply haven't seen those. Nor have I had any discussions from the point at which you asked me that question to the statements made today. So I certainly haven't changed my position. It's not new for New Zealand to include these provisions in trade deals. We did that in the case of recent trade deals, including China. And from the government's perspective, the advice I continue to receive is that it is far-fetched that an investor would be suing New Zealand. Nor do we believe or accept the proposition put up by Jane Kelsey that we somehow cede our sovereignty by signing a free trade agreement.
When you say it's far-fetched, I mean, obviously there has been court cases under NAFTA, under similar provisions. Why is it far-fetched in such...
Because we don't believe the way that the provisions would be structured, that they would allow frivolous claims. And in our view, the way we pass regulation laws in this country would mean that it's extremely unlikely, in our view, far-fetched that we're going to be sued. Certainly, if you look at the China experience as a good example, and I think there's a number of FTAs where we've had the same provisions, New Zealand has neither been sued nor had anyone looking likely that they would sue New Zealand.
When you say not frivolous claims, but I mean there is in fact a court in the World Bank which would be able to deliberate on a lawsuit brought by an investor in New Zealand. So, for example, the state of enterprises that we're planning on selling now, or the government says it's planning on selling.
Yeah. All I can tell you is,
an investor, if you change the regulatory framework, there's a possibility that somebody could sue the government.
Okay. Well, you're free to take any of those questions you might have up with Tim Gross, the Trade Minister. But as far as I'm concerned, the advice I've had is that it's extremely unlikely that we would be getting sued.
Why would the US Trade Representative have told a briefing of civil society that you retracted your comments?
Absolutely no idea. But I've made a single comment in this space to anyone since you last asked me that question in this beehive. So either I've done it telepathically or I haven't done it at all. And I think we take the latter as the likely outcome.
Well, that comment has been referred to repeatedly by both Tim Grosser and by Mark Sinclair and various people in relation to the negotiations. They said the Prime Minister's position hasn't changed.
Correct.
Now the US Trade Representative says it has changed. I mean, you're saying that they're wrong, it hasn't changed?
Well, all I can tell you is, from the moment you asked me that question to the moment you've asked me this question, that is the first time I've discussed this matter.
The speech tomorrow, is there likely to be, obviously you started off with a fairly major announcement.
Yep.
Are you expecting there to be other announcements, or should we expect other announcements?
The speech has a different structure tomorrow. It lays out the government's work program, and so as you would expect, it's quite broad ranging. I think you'd see it more as a theme-based speech. So the first basic theme is we need to have good, strong economic management and we need to get the books back in order. And that was highlighted to a certain degree in my speech earlier in the year. The second part of it is about how do we deliver better outcomes and better results. And that's a combination of, in a lot of our social service areas, being more efficient and effective and also providing better value for money. So it highlights some of the work programs that we have in terms of reform in the state sector, ultimately welfare reform, and other big drivers of cost for the government, all where we're not satisfied that the outcomes are delivering the results that New Zealanders would want. But it's quite a broad-ranging speech, and consistent with what you saw really back in similar speech last year.
One of the big drivers of those costs is continuing higher employment. Do you get the outline here?
Well, look, our overall view is that the six planks of economic growth that we have are the appropriate settings for delivering better jobs in New Zealand. And I think, firstly, if you look globally, it's in terms of the recovery that we've seen around the world, it's been sticky when it comes to jobs. I mean, in the US, very much a jobless recovery, if any recovery is occurring there. Everyone's been struggling a bit with the back half of last year. In the UK went backwards, Australia virtually had zero growth. And the reason for all of that was because the impact of Ireland and then Spain and Greece and Portugal really sucked the wind out of the global economy. So our view is we are on the right track. I think it's also really important to note that unemployment is very much a lagging indicator, not a leading indicator. And in the areas where we see leading indicators, we are starting to see confidence returning. And I think that's a good thing. Now, you know, who knows how it's going to play out this year, but on the balance of probabilities, you would argue that this year is likely to be a much better year than last year was.
And did you suggest this morning that you think it may have
handled up the decision? No. I'd say I can't rule that out. I mean, if you look at what the economists' predictions are for the last quarter, they sort of fluctuate with top end, I think some people are at plus 0.9 and some economists have been negative. So look, you can't rule out a technical recession, but obviously we're hopeful that hasn't been the case. But whatever happens, you'd have to say growth in the last 6 months of last year was fairly anemic, and on that basis obviously clearly want the economy to be going faster, and that's the big aim of the government. And we believe we can do that by lowering interest rates, or at least keeping the pressure off the Reserve Bank so interest rates can stay low, encouraging investment, all the signals that we've been given, and whether it's around labour laws or tax reform and the likes, and being very cautious with government spending.
And then with growth, are you being blaming that squarely on the situation in Europe?
Well, that didn't help. That was a factor that didn't help. But I think Europe also indicates to us how important it is that we preserve our credit rating, and that's why we're taking the steps that we are.
And this push for the single economic market, will that include any more talk about the Trans-Tasman bond?
No, that wouldn't be my expectation.
So would you be signalling further cuts in the public service in your speech?
What you will see tomorrow is a broad sense of where we're going in the public service. And I think what's fair to say is that we have made some changes over the last 2 years. We are running a leaner, more efficient public service, but we do not believe that our work there is done. We're very conscious of the fact that we want to deliver good outcomes and we want to have solid principles. So I think people get very sceptical when, you know, governments just simply push together agencies and then the trend 3 years later comes to break them up. I mean, the principle has to be there's got to be a good reason if there's going to be amalgamations or elimination of services, and there has to be a solid reason why it will deliver a better outcome. And so it's not ideologically driven, it's more principle basis about what do we think a modern day future government should look like in terms of the services it provides. And that won't be a really short run process, but it is something we're starting to talk to chief executives about.
Are you intending to announce any amalgamations? I mean, there have been rumours around Treasury and State Service Commission, for instance, amalgamating more than just the back office, but more thoroughly than that.
Well, I'll leave you to sort of get a feel for that tomorrow.
So is that a yes?
I'll leave you to get a feel for that tomorrow.
I'll try to get a feel for that.
Yeah. What I can tell you is there'll be more detail on that. I mean, there won't be enormous detail on that point tomorrow, but those points will be fleshed out in more detail over the course of the next few months.
Prime Minister, last week you said your modelling performance was a bit... this morning I think your modelling performance was a bit stupid. Isn't it equally unbecoming of Prime Minister to call this really hot on in an interview with a radio personality who was a convicted woman?
Oh, I see them as different things. I mean, look, the reality in terms of sort of modelling of things, I mean, in my job, as it's a function of what I do, that I'm out and about a lot, and that'll continue. You're always put in positions where there are a variety of different things you can do, and that's, I've had a range of them in the 2 years I've been Prime Minister, and long before that as Leader of the Opposition. There'll be plenty more coming up in the 12 months and whatever beyond if we're re-elected. But you know, in that particular instance, yeah, that was a crowd that was boisterous, shall we say. I responded to them. I think it was a bit silly. Learn your lessons. Good question.
There's a lot of negative public comment about your Liz Hurley comments rather than your model performance.
Sure.
But you don't think that your Liz Hurley comments are also a bit stupid?
No.
Nor were you a regular weekly interview with Tony
Fitch? No, I mean, look, I've been on that radio show. I mean, they changed their DJ. It was Darcy Waldegrave and Mark Richardson for a long period of time. I can't control what News Talk ZB do, but they've decided to put Tony Beach on that show. Look, I engage with a lot of journalists. Some of them have history and some of them don't. That's not my concern. My concern is to make sure that I represent the views I want to represent on those shows.
Do you have a concern, though, that it might be seen as running counter to the government's It's Not OK violence campaigns?
No, I don't think so. I mean, look, at the end of the day, he's a guy that's clearly made mistakes, and in the end, hopefully he's learned his lessons from those.
He's a guy that's convicted of kicking a woman in the back after sort of pushing her down a staircase. And, I mean, you can choose whether or not you wish to go on his radio show in particular. I mean, it seems extraordinary to a large number of the people of the public that you've chosen to go on a radio show with that particular DJ.
But there are lots of journalists that have done things wrong in their life.
Like who?
Well, I'm not going to start naming names, but
how many journalists have been convicted of things of that nature?
I don't know, but probably more than one.
Well, how many people do you go regularly on their shows? I mean,
I go on lots of shows every week, but as I say,
Paul Henry was dismissed recently for making a remark which was obviously deeply foolish, but and you approved of that. But again, you're going on a radio show with somebody who's
well, they're your words.
You can also choose not to say that, you know, ask a question about who you think is hot.
Yeah, that's right.
Peter,
did you find an objection or anything that's perhaps a bit
unwise? No. Did you take any advice on whether or not to go on Tony Beach's show when you got the opportunity, or did you think about it?
No.
Did it give you cause for concern? No cause for concern at all?
No.
Quite apart from who the actual host was, why have you chosen to make a weekly regular appearance on a sports jocks show?
Well, because I decided about a year ago, there's quite an intersection actually between sport and politics in lots of different areas. So the government's actively involved in things like the Rugby World Cup. That audience is interested in hearing that. Developments of stadiums in the Rugby World Cup, they're interested in that. I go to miles of different sports awards and different things. We put a lot of money into high performance sport. We put more money into Kiwi sport at schools. So there's a big range of different things. I've been on that show for, let's say, well over 12 months, 14 odd months, and it's a show where there are listeners who are interested in the government's perspective. It's largely about sport, but from time to time they ask issues also about politics. Andy Hayden as an ambassador for the Rugby World Cup. There's a million things that fill up the show.
Isn't it really just a way to sort of attract the bloke's vote?
No, I wouldn't say so. I mean, look, not everyone listens to a specific radio station that we might associate with politics. People listen to a whole range of them. There's a lot of commercial radio stations out there.
Prime Minister Jo Nathan was also on the media last week, and she was criticising her government saying that they were low-income families.
Yeah. Look, I think if you look at the conditions we're in, so we have to put a bit of perspective around that. No one's arguing it's not tough for low-income New Zealanders. It actually has been pretty tough for a very, very long period of time. Decades, I might argue, actually. So I think from that perspective, I think we've done as good a job as we can do in the conditions we've got to try and help lower-income New Zealanders. We've moved the minimum wage from $12 to $13. We've focused two-thirds of our tax cut program into low- to middle-income New Zealanders. Some of the moves we've made, for instance, if you look at the 90-day trial period, has been acknowledged now as something that's very likely to create additional jobs, as in the most recent research we've seen. Right through to the changes we made around employment contracts law, essentially in terms of a contractor, you know, save thousands of jobs, some of them would be low-income New Zealanders. So my view is we've made quite a lot of progress. That whole street, you look at McGee and Close, and the last advice I had, I think there's been widespread installation programs in that street. So, you know, it's a long-run process lifting the opportunities for New Zealanders that are in low-income. No one's arguing that.
Her own circumstances have gone nowhere, and she seems to blame you for that. For whatever reason, you know, her case was sort of seen as a test case because her daughter went with you to Waitangi.
Yeah.
And
I'd reject that view, but leave it to you to go and ask some of the harder questions.
She also called you an a-hole. Are you an a-hole?
I don't think so, but again, I'll leave others to judge that.
You say you think the Euro crisis is to blame for part of those economic problems. What do you think of the other things to blame for the anemic growth over the last...
There's been a lot of different factors out there. I mean, it's been a much stickier recovery than people actually thought. I mean, if you look in Europe and the United States, the expectations would have been much stronger growth there. There's been a number of different factors. We've seen Canterbury in terms of the earthquake had quite a big impact on the household labour force survey and on growth in Christchurch, which has sort of been negative. So, I mean, there's a number of different factors. We also had at one point there were some climatic conditions which caused us, you know, we lost a lot of lambs in the South Island. So there's a range of different factors in there. But, you know, at the end of the day, I mean, New Zealand grew last year. It was growth that was at a lower level than what clearly we want. We also created 27,000 jobs as an economy last year. Again, less than we'd want for population growth. But all we can do is work within the global conditions we're in and have a program for lifting overall growth. And I think if you go back to the program we've got, whether it's around tax or infrastructure investment or skills or labour laws, or any of those other issues, as a combined package, in my view, they are the right long-term recipe for growth. And I think you can't measure these things day by day or quarter by quarter. You have to measure them over a reasonable period of time.
Everyone's been pushing for a...
To give you one example of that, by the way, I'm sorry to interrupt. I mean, the Reserve Bank themselves will tell you that if New Zealanders had consumed in 2010 at the same rate that they drew down debt in 2007... growth would have been nearly 6% last year. Now, we actually don't want them consuming debt at those levels. We're actually very happy with the rebalancing that's going on. But what drove growth in that period from 2000 to 2008 was unsustainable. It was consumption, and it was debt-fueled, and it was spending other people's money. That is not a long-term recipe for the New Zealand economy. That has to be around investments, savings, and lifting the tradable sector.
How did it get so sticky? Why aren't businesses employing as many people as you thought as you wanted to.
Well, I think they are starting to, but I mean,
They said that at the start of last year.
Well, they grew 27,000 jobs last year. They're starting to, but they need the right signals internationally as well, and they're starting to see that. I mean, my sense of being around in the first few months of this year is confidence is actually starting to return.
So they need the right signals.
Unemployment's always a lagging indicator.
Yeah, but do they need the right signals nationally as well? I mean, they're not just going off.
Well, the signals they want are the ones that we've been giving them, that the government's not going to crowd them out, that the government is going to be careful with the legislation and regulation that passes, that it is going to be predictable in terms of things like its emissions trading legislation, that it is going to have flexible labour markets, that will be investing in infrastructure, that it won't be crowding them out by borrowing too much money each week, that we are going to get back into surplus earlier, that we have a tax system that has integrity, that we are going to run a leaner government service, that we are reforming the Resource Management Act, that we are looking at the critical issues of water, that we have resolved some of the issues around electricity, that we are looking at a mixed ownership model to have better productivity. I can go on if you want me to, but there is no one single fix. If I could just click my fingers and do it, we'd all do it. But it ain't as simple as that. An economy is a very complex issue. But overall, if you look at the settings we're on, I think the reason the business community is supporting us and the way that we see through Mood of the Boardroom and other public reports, it is because there's a whole package there which is coherent. And if you contrast that with the previous administration and the now Phil Gough-led opposition, he wants to spend more money and borrow more money. And I don't think that's going to take us anywhere other than further into debt.
When Labor and the unions talk about a job strategy and say that we don't have one, are you saying that National doesn't have a job strategy in isolation? It just doesn't have one per se?
Well, I don't think anyone sits around and says, we're going to create 10,000 jobs. We sit around and say, we're going to have a platform which will be conducive to strong job growth.
But what about things that they talk about, like upskilling?
Well, let's have a look at the things that they want to do. So, first thing they want to do is they want to have an extension of the ETS. So that is going to put a significant cost on consumers today. Very unlikely to do much for consumer demand. Certainly like to have quite a big impact on business and will be more draconian than what we see around the rest of the world. Second thing they want to do is they want to have a high top personal tax rate. So very unlikely to encourage that sector of the economy, which is a sector that pays a lot of tax and employs a lot of people, to want to come here and stay here. They do not want to have the Hobbit movies made in New Zealand, so you better write off those 3,000 jobs before you even start. They do not want a 90-day trial period. And by the way, that's the thing that's, as the Department of Labour Research has shown, has created a lot of jobs. And it goes on and on. So in the end, I mean, they can criticise, but their programme is not a job-rich one. It's spend more money that we don't have, that we need to borrow from other people.
I was going to say, Peter Dunn, thinks Waitangi Day has been hijacked by protesters. He'd like to see a New Zealand Day, inclusive of all New Zealanders. Is that something you'd support?
Change to a New Zealand Day?
Or just a separate New Zealand Day?
Look, no, I think at the moment, I mean, my view is that we shouldn't overstate the impact that those, isolated group of protesters have at Waitangi. You know, for the most part, it's actually a very positive festival type atmosphere there. It's one of the key messages I was trying to get out, that I want New Zealanders to feel that they can go to Waitangi and enjoy the significance of that time. What you see through the TV screens or in your newspapers or here on the radios is very heavily focused on a very small group who use that platform to target and vent their frustrations at the government, in this case at me as Prime Minister. But I don't think that's reflective of the way the vast overwhelming bulk of New Zealanders, Maori or Pākehā, feel about Waitangi Day.
Peter Dunn also said over the weekend he'd like to look at working for families being able to capitalise their families' credits as a lump sum in order to buy a house. Would that be something you'd consider looking at?
We haven't had any advice on that. I'm not quite sure how that would work. I mean, there's a lot of different factors that can change there. I mean, working for families is subject to your income. So one of the problems with that is you could end up having people capitalising their working for families grants to have a change in their earning status and then having quite a big liability. So I haven't looked at it, but I'd say it's challenging.
Prime Minister, where do you see the single economic market going?
Well, hopefully, continuing to deliver big gains for both countries. I think if you go back and look at CER, that is the most comprehensive trade agreement between two individual countries. The single economic market is an extension now really into the capital markets and the investment markets, and we want to see more and greater progress there. And if you look at CER and you look at the growth in two-way trade between the two countries, pretty much each and every year it's outstripped growth we've seen in other parts of the world. So I think it's been very successful for Australia and New Zealand. The more we can sensibly integrate our investment markets, and I think the better that is. There will always be some caveats and there's always some sticking points, and they're quite well defined, the ones that are there, but I think we can do better, and we've been making some progress. We'd like to do more.
What would you see as the main sticking points?
Well, I think like imputation of tax credits is always a bit of a bugbear.
Would amalgamation of the NZX and ASX help?
Well, that's not something that's likely, given I think the ASX itself is just on a deal with the Singapore Exchange. For start-off, then probably not likely anymore.
So you're expecting progress on imputation credits and banking mutual recognition?
No, well, I don't think I'd say that. What I'd say is that's a sticking point.
You're pushing it again.
Look, it's always on the agenda. And I know it's something the billing was just taken up with Wayne Swan. They are looking at the issue, but I wouldn't hold my breath that it's going to happen anytime soon. Thanks.